Okay. This lesson today, we're going to look at, I guess, the two kingdoms as James gets a bit older, and but the sort of habits that he forms really will stay with him throughout his life. Okay, so we left off last time in 1583. James had spent nearly 10 months in captivity. It wasn't like he was in a dungeon or prison cell or anything. He was out. In fact, he escaped by just one day when he was riding out hunting. He just rode further than he would have gone otherwise. But anyways, he escaped on the 26th of June. He turned 17 the week before. So just to give you an idea of how old he was, he was 17. Okay, while he was in captivity, so to speak, George Buchanan died on the 28th of September, 1582. So, later James, he despised much about Buchanan, although at times he spoke highly of his learning. I guess if it reflected well on James, then he would speak highly of Buchanan. But, so, he was not a modest young man by any means. He'd written a letter to one of his cousins in France. I think it was the Duke of Guise, and he made some comment about how he was so well known for his wisdom and so on. And he said something like it being from that part of the family or something. And if I remember right, the reader of the letter wrote in the margin, "A modest young man, a young gentleman." So. Okay, well, once he escaped, he again surrounded himself with the worst kind of counselors. Okay, Esme Stuart had gone to France and had died there. But the Earl of Arran, formerly Captain James Stuart, had returned to James' side where he could further enrich himself. James Stuart was someone who pretty much lived for his own enrichment. In fact, he finally succeeded in alienating almost everyone in the kingdom, but that was a little bit down the road. Okay, notwithstanding the promises that James had made, he began to take revenge on those who had participated in keeping him captive and those who had publicly approved it. So he banished John Dury, the preacher with the haggblet, from Edinburgh again, because he had approved of this. Okay, so it didn't take too long for him to start to revenge himself in a more serious way. On the 15th of February, 1584, he summoned Andrew Melville was summoned to appear before the Privy Council on Monday the 17th. When he did appear, it transpired that someone had misinformed the council of the contents of his preaching at St. Andrews. And so the council was wanting to try him for treason or sedition, and because of his preaching. So this is directly sort of a two kingdoms issue. And they, when Melville came in, he first requested that he made sort of a list of requests. First of all, that his trial should be remitted to the ecclesiastical courts, at least first, and that he should be tried at St. Andrews, where he's supposedly... where the alleged offense had committed. Let's see. That if his first request shouldn't be granted, that he should at least enjoy the privileges of the university which he was a member. Universities in those days had quite a high standing in terms of the law. A lot of sort of town and gown incidents in Britain were caused by the fact that the students weren't quite under the same authority as everyone else. And fourthly, let's see, that he should, that against an elder they should receive not an accusation but before two or three witnesses. And fifthly, that he should have the benefit of a free subject by being made acquainted with his accuser. And that the individual appeared in that character should, if the charge turned out to be false and calumnious, be liable to the punishment prescribed by the statutes against those who seek to alienate the king from his faithful subjects. In fine, he protested that if William Stuart was the informer, he had just ground to accept against him, both as an accuser and as a witness, inasmuch as he had entertained a deadly malice against them and had frequently threatened to do him bodily harm if it was in his power. Okay, so after he'd given his objections, the council adjourned to the next day. And in the meantime, he drew up a written protest with these things in it. Okay, this written protest infuriated the king and the Earl of Arran, and they stirred up the Privy Council. And the next day, they broached the subject of how he was declining their authority. Okay, now he hadn't used the term declinature. This is something that later comes up in Scottish church history a fair amount, where the say the ministers will decline the authority of the king. He hadn't used those terms, but in essence, that's what he was doing. So, let's see, reading from McCree, he says he resolutely defended the step which he had taken and told the councillors that when there was a constituted church in the country, they shewed themselves too bold in passing by its teachers and assuming a right to pronounce sentence on the doctrine and control the administrations of the servants of a king and council greater than themselves. And this is Melville being quoted, and that you may see your weakness and rashness in the taking upon you what you neither can nor ought to do, and clasping his Hebrew Bible from his girdle and throwing it on the table, he said, "These are my instructions. See if any of you can judge of them or show that I have passed my injunctions." Arran took up the book, and perceiving it to be written in a strange language, gave it to the king, saying, "Sir, he scorns your majesty and the council." "No, my lords," replied Melville, "I scorn not, but with all earnestness, zeal, and gravity, I stand for the cause of Jesus Christ and his church." So, whips out his Hebrew Bible and tells him, that they need to show their authority from there, which, in the nature of the case, they'd find hard to do. The trial went ahead, despite him protesting their authority, and the principal witness was this William Stuart, who had some kind of vendetta against Melville. Okay, but it turned out none of the testimony was actually particularly incriminating. It had transpired earlier that someone had sort of twisted what he said and sort of added to it quite a bit to make it sound more seditious. But they nevertheless convicted him of declining the judgment of the council and behaving in an irreverent fashion before the council. So he was sentenced to be imprisoned in Edinburgh Castle and to be, quote, further punished in his person and goods at His Majesty's pleasure. Okay, so Melville's nephew, James Melville, did some sort of querying to find out what was really going to happen. I mean, just being thrown into prison, might not be that bad, or it could be quite bad. And it turned out that while this was happening, after he'd left for the day, they decided to change the prison to the castle at Blackness. And some of the courtiers thought that he would not be expected to come out alive. So in other words, if he left the castle at all, it would be to ascend the steps of a scaffold. So that night, he slipped out of Edinburgh, and by the next night, he was in Berwick in England. So the Privy Council, though, soon found out that they weren't exactly very popular for having forced Melville to flee the country. He was the foremost man of letters in his day.
Yeah. He's accused of being irreverent?
To the council, yeah, and declining their authority. They were going to throw him into prison and punish him in some yet to be described fashion. So that was... Yeah, so he wasn't actually found guilty of what he was charged with. He was just found guilty of the way he defended himself. Probably whipping out his Bible there, probably was, So, okay, but they found out they weren't all that popular for having sent this guy into exile. So they tried to, I'll say, spin the situation. Well, that's certainly not a word they would have used. With a proclamation that he'd voluntarily exiled himself, and they had no intention of mistreating him. But then they also passed an act stipulating that accused preachers should, in the future, be detained without the formality of legal charge being filed. So their effort in shifting the blame was not very successful, since they declared legally that they could just throw the guy in prison and then worry about what the charges might be. Okay, because this is an issue that comes up again and again. I thought we might think a little bit about the nature of what the Melville's claims were. So people who wanted to sort of mischaracterize what he said claimed that it was sort of an absolute claim of all immunity from prosecution by the civil magistrate. Okay, in fact, this was the sort of standard, as I understand it, Catholic Church position, that their priests were immune from civil law. Right, and actually this idea stays with us today, right? The idea of diplomatic immunity. Right, so if you're an ambassador for Christ, then you'd be, in a sense, immune from prosecution. Okay, but rather what they were actually claiming was just that the church had the right to first try any ministers for the content of their sermons. And so you can see with sort of what we might call multiple controlling authorities, as opposed to no controlling authorities, the minister is a subject of one kingdom, he's an ambassador of another kingdom, so it was necessary to have some protocol, and they'd actually had a previous agreement along these lines, but it was conveniently forgotten. Okay, but this wouldn't preclude the magistrate from being or the minister from being tried by the civil magistrate for seditious or treasonous preaching, or I presume for, you know, libel and so on, that he could still be tried, but rather he would, under the church's claim, he would be tried first by the church. And I was just saying, or for that matter, you know, maybe the church would just lose its tax-exempt status for making certain kinds of political statements. Other kinds of political statements being okay. So the battle for prerogative, which this is part of, hasn't ended, but the means to accomplish the state's ends have become subtler, or I should say, usually they've become subtler. Okay, and to quote McCree, he says, despotism has rarely been established in any nation without the subserviency of the ministers of religion. Which I think is a very true statement, that despotism usually depends on this, either relying on it existing already or on creating this subserviency. Okay, so very shortly after that, they issued a proclamation exiling the lords of the enterprise, as they were called. And these were the lords who had captured James, well, now 2 years before. And one of them, Gowrie, who was, despite James's earlier promise to treat him fairly and not to proceed with any charges against him, he was captured and executed. So, but the rest of the lords fled to England. Okay, then 2 months later, May of 1584, the Parliament went a great deal further to restrict the constrain the church. They, in a sort of a secretive process, they had the lords of the Articles who drew up the drafted the legislation. They met secretly. The Parliament was held behind closed doors. Some ministers tried to go to the Parliament meeting of Parliament, but it was they were barred at the door. Let's see, two bishops sat in the Parliament. Montgomery, who's the guy we discussed before, sort of went back and forth, being a bishop and then being under the submitting himself to his brother ministers. And Patrick Adamson, who I don't think we've discussed before, but it's kind of an interesting case, so a little bit of background on him. He was a 1558 graduate of St. Andrews. He was approved for ministering in the church by the General Assembly in December of 1560. By 1563, he was deemed fit enough to not only minister in a church, but also to plant churches in northeast Scotland. 1572, he preached a well-known sermon, distinguishing between the concepts of my lord bishop, which would be the sort of Catholic concept of a bishop, my lord's bishop, which would be the Episcopalian one, or court, you know, the court-appointed bishop, and the Lord's bishop, in other words, a minister of the gospel. And he was preaching against the appointment of John Douglas to the Archbishopric of Glasgow. Okay, so that was 1572, but nevertheless, he was appointed to be Morton's chaplain. If you remember when Melville returned to Scotland, Morton tried to appoint him as his chaplain. he demurred. But 4 years later, in 1576, Adamson was appointed Archbishop of St. Andrews and didn't complain about it. Okay, so at this point he was at odds with the General Assembly, and he was rebuked and threatened with excommunication several times. So it sort of went back and forth with him going in submission and then not being rebuked. But with the change in political situation in 1583, he became the foremost apologist for episcopacy by divine right, and also for the king's absolute rule over both the secular kingdom and the church. And let's see, in late 1583 through up right up until before this parliament, he was in England consulting with archbishops there, and he was doing various things to sort of run down Presbyterian government, writing letters to churches on the continent and so on. But later, when James becomes king, he actually when he tries to force the church in England and the church in Scotland to be alike, but of course he doesn't try to force Presbyterianism on the church in England, he tries to force episcopacy on the church in Scotland. And James sort of uses this as an excuse that he thinks that the kingdoms need to be united in terms of worship. Charles I does the same thing, and this causes a number of incidents with the in the side of the Scottish church. Okay, so Adamson returned to Scotland at a propitious time to help guide this development of the Black Acts to overthrow Presbyterianism. And they included the following. The first one was fairly innocuous. It authorized the preaching of the true word according to the Confession of Faith. The second one confirmed the king's authority over all states and persons. In other words, over both the secular kingdom, if you will, and over the church. It made it a treasonous act to, quote, seek or procure the diminution of power and authority of the same three estates, or any of them in time coming under the pain of treason. The three estates were the nobles, the bishops, and the burgesses, or representatives of the burghs. And so, in sort of one swoop, this legally reestablished the bishops and made it a crime to preach otherwise. In other words, seeking or procuring the diminution of the power or authority of the three estates. Well, if you preached against the bishops, you'd be guilty of violating this. Okay, the fourth act eliminated the right of the church to meet. In other words, convoking the king's lieges without permission of the king. And as, to quote James Hewison King, he wrote, "The sweeping act wiped out the autonomy of the church and converted the church into a department of James' government, which licensed its assemblies and reviewed its edicts. Thus the acts was laid at the root of the church, more especially when the next act provided for the deposition of any pastor for any kind of offense by the bishop or royal commissioner." So, really they banned the assemblies, except unless the king approved, and then really left all the power to organize the church and the church's doings with the bishops. Let's see, the Eighth Act banned possession of books by George Buchanan, specifically De Jure Regne and his History of Scotland. I actually brought with me source book of Scottish history. This is volume 3 here, and it actually has the it doesn't have all the Black Acts, but it has a number of them quoted in here. Let's see. The Presbyterians. Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't, they didn't call it the Black Acts when they passed it. So I said that they were putting all the church, or the organization of the church, under here. Let me try to read just one of the acts, which is fairly short. "Our Sovereign Lord and his three estates of Parliament statutes and ordains that Patrick, Archbishop of St. Andrews, and other bishops within this realm use and exercise the function and authority of bishops, with such others as shall constitute the King's Majesty's commissioners in ecclesiastical causes, shall and may direct and put order to all matters and causes ecclesiastical within their diocese, visit the kirks and state of the ministry within the same. Reform the colleges therein. We save His Highness's presentations to benefices, and give collations thereupon as they shall find the persons present qualified and worthy, and make report of such as they find is insufficient in due time, and that no presentation to benefices be directed in time coming to any others. So, it left sort of almost all the authority in the hands of the church. This is number 20. I'll pass this around because you might want to see it in the original Scots. Not exactly as I read it there, but it starts right there. Okay, now, as you can imagine, they weren't satisfied with just passing these laws, right? They actually wanted to enforce them. And some of the ministers protested the acts. They were supposed to be apprehended, but they fled the country instead. And more than 20 ministers actually followed them to England. So, if you're thinking by now, well, there's a lot of Scots in England. You're right, there are a lot. A lot in England who have fled the country. Okay, so Aaron, he threatened a number of the remaining ministers. He's particularly coarse in his threatenings. I'll get to this in a minute, I guess. He imprisoned several of them. One was tried for his life for praying for the other ministers. Okay, he was acquitted by a jury, but then he was immediately indicted for corresponding with rebels. His corresponding with rebels was he had read a letter that one of the other ministers wrote to his wife. So this other minister wrote a letter of comfort to his wife. She apparently visited in prison and showed it to him, and that was made him guilty of the crime of corresponding with rebels. And for this, he was sentenced to death. The sentence wasn't carried out, but outside this poor man's prison window, they built a scaffold and left it there for several weeks while he was sat in prison waiting to be executed. I don't know what happened to him after that, but I guess he must have been released eventually. Okay, next the ministers were forced to subscribe a bond to obey the Black Acts and to acknowledge that bishops were their rightful ecclesiastical superiors. Okay, when a number of them wouldn't subscribe, they were gathered together at a meeting where the Earl of Arran threatened them with bodily torture and so on. I forget the exact list of things he was going to do to them. Actually, if I can find that quickly, you might find it... Not entertaining, but just informative. Oh, he threatened that he would shave their heads, pare their nails, cut their toes, make them an example to all rebels. Okay. So, that didn't work, threatening them. But what did work was the Archbishop of St. Andrews came up with a compromise, the addition of a phrase, quote, "One of those ambiguous and unmeaning clauses which serve only to blind the simple and to salve the consciences of those of such as are anxious to escape from trouble." Okay, the phrase that they added was that they would obey the bishops, etc., according to the word of God. And James Melville, Andrew Melville's nephew, in a letter characterized this as if one should say he would obey the Pope and his prelates according to the word of God. Okay, but nevertheless, a number of well-known ministers, including John Gregg and Dury, succumbed and they signed this bond. So, okay, but still the king, Aaron, and Adamson weren't satisfied, and they continued their efforts to press the church into the ground. They demanded even more specific approvals of things from the ministers, so not just one bond, but you know, they kept having to sort of sign on to additional things. And they suppressed the teaching of theology at the universities, and they threw the exiled ministers' wives and families out of the manses. Not all of them, but some of them they threw out, kicked them out. So, okay, Aaron was really drunk for power. He was extremely abusive of all who got in his way. He eventually succeeded in alienating almost everyone, and according to one of James's biographers, Aaron was the most hated man in Scotland. Okay, it even started to irritate the king. And at the same time, all these political negotiations were still swirling around England. We've talked before about like the Catholic scares and so on, but that really hadn't gone away. In fact, what in 15, was it? Yeah, right. The Spanish Armada sailed in August of 1588, and this is a few years before that, but all these negotiations about Mary plots are still swirling around. There were negotiations going on with Elizabeth that she managed to make, or he managed to make Elizabeth very mad at him. So I guess he was the most hated man in Scotland, and maybe at least maybe in England, or at least in Elizabeth's court. So finally, in October 1585, some 20 months later, the banished lords returned from England. Elizabeth told them to go ahead and go back. I don't know that she promised any support, but she may have. When they came back, they sort of dispersed and gathered troops, and they raised an army of 8,000 men, and they marched on Stirling Castle. Okay, Aaron was there at the time. When he saw the troops, he fled for his life. James, depending on which account if you read, he greeted, depending on which one is true, if any, he greeted the lords and either gracefully or cheerfully or otherwise accepted them and formed basically a new government on the 4th of November, 1585. The exiled ministers also returned, and the persecution was relaxed right away. But the king didn't immediately back down. He still tried to sort of maintain the general control that he had with these acts. Nor was the king. Remember, if we think about like Mary, Queen of Scots, I think she was very, for the most part, personally aloof from all this. I mean, yes, she interviewed Knox a few times, got mad at him, but I mean, she wasn't. She didn't really care what Knox preached. I mean, she didn't like what he preached, but you know, she wasn't going to go get in. She never got into a discourse with him seriously on the theology of what he preached. Well, James was probably the opposite. He was very interested in all of this and wanted to press his point. So he went so far as to personally harass some of the preachers. He actually personally, himself, the king, interrupted one of the preachers, Walter Balquhanqual, while he was preaching at St. Giles, and he was shouted dissents over the loft at him. So, James, of course, he was extremely intelligent, and he also thought he was extremely intelligent. He was, as someone else said, the wisest fool in Christendom. James was called the wisest fool in Christendom. It was called that at the time. I mean, it was. Yeah, he was very. He was extremely smart, but he was also very full of himself. He would make all these brags to him. There's contemporary reports of ambassadors basically went to see him, and what they wrote back. You know, they wrote back that he goes hunting all the time and hawking, but he says when he comes back, he can do the work of five men, or what it would take other men 6 hours to do, he can do in 1 hour, and would just make all these kind of claims. About how intelligent he was and everything. So, okay, in April 1586, at a meeting of the Synod of Fife, Professor James Melville, who was, again, Andrew Melville's nephew, he preached from the text, that's right here, "Every man that is among you is not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think." I was at the Free Church of Scotland in Edmonton last week. That was the text that the pastor preached on. But he wasn't preaching against bishops here. Adamson was actually in the audience, and Melville then went on to make the practical application. He exhorted the brethren to lop off that, quote, "most corrupt and monstrous member," Adamson. Okay, so Adamson was excommunicated by the synod. Okay. And then there was the... Okay, so this went up to the General Assembly, which met at Holyrood House in May 1586. And it was at least partly by the king's invitation. So you recall that they weren't supposed to set up their own assemblies. He apparently agreed to one. The king tried to sort of maintain episcopacy, but with a friendlier face, or a Presbyterian-sounding face, if you will. And Adamson agreed then to submit to his brethren. And for the rest of his career, he was alternately sort of submitting and then being excommunicated by the other ministers. So he died in 1592. Okay, so with the war in the air, the Spanish Armada was expected any time, plots everywhere, scheming, and there's a lot of very interesting history about James and his mother and her trying to reach these agreements where she could be a queen and he would rule in association with her and so on. Elizabeth finally had Mary executed on the 8th of February, 1587. Now, I say Elizabeth had her executed. I guess the usual story is that Elizabeth signed the death warrant but claimed afterwards that she didn't really expect it to be used. But in any case, Mary was executed on the 8th of February, 1587. Leading up to this, James had commanded the ministers to pray a set prayer for her. Some of the ministers, a number of them refused to pray that prayer for her as written. But after she was executed, James pretty much forgot about it. He hardly could have cared less for his mother. I mean, this is one of the things these ambassadors commented on, that he didn't even ask how she was living, or if she needed anything or anything like that. He just talked about himself. So, okay, then later that year, Parliament passed an act which annexed most of the church's possessions to the crown. And I say most of the possessions. I'm not sure what percentage it was, but it exempted the manses and apparently, I guess, the churches, some of the tithes and so on, but most of the benefices that they've been arguing about, all the patronage, was all annexed to the crown. Further concerns about the Armada sort of swept to a fever pitch, and there was a fair amount of religious sort of activity, fervor in the country. I guess we may discuss a little bit next time, but the Armada was destroyed then in August of 1588, right? It sailed in and towards England, and I think providentially it was pretty much destroyed. Very few of the ships that sailed to England sailed back home. So we'll stop there. Questions, rabbit trails, discussions.
Why did they why did they spend a lot of that? I mean, they knew the guy was taken, submit when he thought was worthy, and then he was just unsubmit when he felt like it. Why, for the second, third time, was they able to communicate it and not even ask again?
That's a good question. I don't know the whole answer to it. I was reading through sort of a list of things they had done.
It looks to me like you're on great harm to the church. They should have communication with Mary no dead again.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I don't know if there was a... I mean, I would guess there's was a political consideration, but I don't know. We may look at that next week. I'm not sure. So, I mean, I have looked at a list of things he'd done. Not all of them were on the same level as what he'd done before, but...
And as this Spanish Armada was coming, did we have any apostolic conversions from King James himself? Did he also become religious?
Yes, actually. That was what...
Did he show up on church on Easter?
Yeah. Well, I think he showed up at church regularly, if for no other reason than to argue with the preacher. I don't know if he always showed up. In fact, I don't think he always showed up at church regularly, but I do know he went enough to have various interchanges and so on. I think I forget which book mentioned as rogues often do, sort of convert to religion in times of crisis. I think he even wrote a book on, something on Revelation, maybe not a complete book, but...
I bet you came out of church with the Bible in his hand, didn't he?
Probably. Bible under his hand.
Yes.
But we don't know what he did on Sunday afternoon,
yeah.
So...
No.
Other questions? Discussion? Whatever?
Back again to these pastors that we've gotten out where they fled to England.
Right.
Go along with the Black Act.
Uh-huh.
Okay. We have coming back. I guess
I'm sorry.
Don't we have lords coming back?
Right, and the ministers.
And the ministers came back.
I don't know if they came back exactly together, but they did all come back about the same time.
What power did she have to sit there and say you all go back? There has to be. I mean, the kings have been waiting for the slaughter with the king.
Well, despite the Earl of Arran's sort of personally ferocious demeanor, I don't think he was a very successful general organizer of men. He thrived basically by having sort of the king at his side. Right when the king was captured, the Earl of Arran sort of disappeared. He didn't, you know, he could have raised an army, right, to free him if he was such a great leader. So, no, I don't think there was any army of any size to meet them.
So they came back with an army.
Well, they formed an army shortly thereafter. There's actually sort of a series of events that led up to this. In the summer, at some point, the son of the Earl of Bedford was killed in a border scuffle. And I don't know the exact what led up to that, but this was one of Elizabeth's subjects was killed by one of Arran's men in a border scuffle. And Arran was, for whatever reason, suspected of being art and part of it. In other words, not just a random, you know, little incident that got out of control at the border, but he was somehow suspected of more than that. James actually had to put him in jail in Stirling Castle at the end of July. Earlier, they'd been negotiating. I think Elizabeth had finally made some kind of promise of financial support. And there had been various negotiations going on. The Scots originally wanted £10,000 a year. The ambassador who brought the offer forward was worried because it had been cut from, Elizabeth had cut it from £5,000 a year to £4,000 a year. He was worried. The Scots had earlier turned down £2,500 as an insult. None of it makes very much sense today. But in any case, James had accepted these terms and was said how wonderful they were and how everything was to his liking and everything. And then Arran has this guy killed, and all of a sudden James has to choose between Arran and Elizabeth. At least he thinks he does. So he apparently wept for a long time because he told Elizabeth's ambassador that he would not want to be thought to be a dissembler. That she would think he was a liar if he didn't turn over Arran and cooperate. But then in a few weeks he got over it and he started making noises like, well, you know, maybe he would look at things differently. Elizabeth eventually just got fed up with the situation. And I don't know if she offered any other inducement in terms of arms, troops, money. You know, I haven't looked into it that far. All I know is that she encouraged them to go back across the border. It was with her blessing to return. And when they did, at this point, Arran was so unpopular, apparently had no problem raising enough, 8,000 men to fight. So that's a long way of sort of answering your question, I think. No, he fled, and the book that I read said he disappeared into political obscurity. So, Chris, this would sort of be consistent with his behavior on past occasions. That's what he did when James was captured. He sort of disappeared for a little while. So, he was said to be an adventurer. I think somebody who, as long as he could get his way, he was quite bold. But when things turned against him, he just disappeared.
Took a poll,
yeah. Found out. Look, I'm the least popular man in Scotland. Woe is me. Yeah. So, okay. Well, Mike, would you close in prayer?